I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Stock prices are spiking again. The Dow Jones average, which lapsed below 10,000 earlier this month, is crowding the 11,000 line once more. And the high-tech NASDAQ market outran the big board yesterday with another sharp gain. This is what Alan Greenspan meant by the irrational exuberance of market investors. He coined that phrase years ago when the market and the exuberance were about half of their peaks today. Our guest, the Yale economist Robert Shiller, has made irrational exuberance the title of an important new book, arguing again that the doubters and the bears will be proven right in the end because it is a bubble and because bubbles burst. A Dow Jones average to match corporate earnings and real growth in this economy would be somewhere around 6,000, Professor Shiller believes, not 11,000. But who wants to sell out of those internet stocks now? Our second guest, the forecaster Alan Sinai, is here with the counter story. He says the new economy, this electronic transformation, is real and it's valuable, not least because of the way the giants of the old economy are using it so effectively for productivity and buying into it now as fast as they can. Connection listeners, rational or irrational? Make the exuberance connection at 1-800-423-8255. The Dow at 6,000. Or at 36,000, as Jim Glassman and Kevin Hassett revalued it last year. Where is the floor under this economy? And what are the rising oil prices and interest rates doing to it? Give the economist a call, 1-800-423-TALK. Professor Shiller, the wet blanket goes first. You refer to this market as a naturally occurring Ponzi scheme, meaning a sort of non-criminal scam. How did it get there? What's wrong with this 11,000 Dow?
Well, how it got there is through public thinking. It's not there because these internet profits are there yet. So we are embarking on a grand experiment, and people are extremely confident. And this is something that developed by people talking to people.
But you say public thinking, but what is the basis of it? It doesn't have to be, you know, this year's corporate earnings of the new stock.
Okay, well, this is what my book is about. Most people are puzzled by the market because it shoots up and there's so many possible factors. So the structure of my book is first to list precipitating factors, what exogenous events really spurred this, and then to talk about other things that help these factors to have such an impact on the market.
Yeah, I read the book and the list of 12 factors with great interest. I mean, you allude to the Newt Gingrich Congress and capital gains tax cuts and the rise of day trading and the growth of mutual funds and all sorts of things. It seems to me you give rather a small place, though, to what most people seem to think is the basis of it, a real, not just the internet or those dot-com companies, but a deep, permanent, almost incomparable electronic transformation of industry. I mean,
That is very important. It's been going on. Well, we could date it to when did the telegraph come in? That was the most dramatic electronic. And then the telephone in 1876.
1850, in the 1850s.
Yeah.
Thoreau dismissed it. He didn't buy any of that stock.
I think the telegraph is the one. That's the big one. Once you have that, you can communicate all around the world at the speed of electricity. That was the big one. The internet is less important. And less important than the telephone. The telephone you can do wonderful things with the telephone. For example, you can do the Amazon.com business in 1925. The only difference is that people have to make a little phone call. It's the same business. So the thing that empowered that was the telephone.
There's a whole web of technologies here, including the computer, let's not forget that, that have radically changed productivity. I mean, I'll let Alan Sinai make the professional argument, but that's the basis of this market, is it not, of the exuberance, rational or otherwise?
Well, you got to remember, productivity has been in a slump for the 70s and 80s, and it's just recovering from that. I think people are overreacting to it. It hasn't been such a radical change yet.
Your whole argument, though, is that nothing fundamental has changed in this economy.
The thing to remember is that the past century, or maybe the past two centuries, have been ones of great growth for most countries of the world. And we are continuing that, and I expect that to continue. We're going to be in a much better world. But the critical thing to realize is that it's a continuation of long-term trends. And maybe productivity is up a little bit, but people overreact to the little blips in these theories.
Alan Sinai, what's real in this transformation?
What's real is...
Professor Shor is dismissing.
What's real is a kind of incredible shift in how we produce, consume, and distribute the goods and services that underlie this economy. It's very fundamental. It's very different. We don't have enough data in terms of the statistical agency's production of data because the world is changing so fast. And so, unfortunately, for scientists like Bob and the part of me that's a scientist, the anecdotal evidence and what we see is not fully satisfactory. But, you know, markets have a way of telling you in advance, because there's a lot of money on the line, when there is a real fundamental shift. And they always overdo it. That is for sure. Markets get too exuberant and they get too pessimistic in terms of the rationality of pricing. But the fundamental discrepancy between the messages of the Dow Jones, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ so far this year, and actually since the second half of last year, is very, very striking. And it really does say we have a new economy versus an old economy. Investors around the world are pricing these companies' prospects differently. And I think they're doing that because the revenue prospects, the growth prospects for what is called the new economy companies are radically different from the revenue and earnings prospects going ahead now the next 5 years of what is at the moment called the old companies.
You have the same kind of Harvard brand training that Professor Shiller has. Why do you disagree so fundamentally here? What's wrong with his picture?
I think... there's nothing really wrong with Bob's picture in the context and framework that he brings to his research. He is a stellar researcher. Actually, Bob, my son, just to date me a little bit, took a course of yours at Yale. Oh. He did his degree in math and economics at Yale and had a course that he thought was terrific.
Oh, is that Todd?
That's correct.
No. Oh, okay. Yeah.
he's the famous one of the two of us. And I think what's different is that I do my work in the world of finance and markets and business people and see a lot of things that Bob probably doesn't see, given where he spends most of his time. And as a result of what I see and what markets say, we, my group, and I are driven to research these topics to see whether there's truth in it or not. So for a decade now, I've been one of those new economist folks arguing that the fundamental trends of the U.S. economy, inflation, unemployment have changed. And I've argued for years that the NARU, the natural rate, would not work in this episode because we have major changes in the structure of our economy and our system and of the world. The old rules of economics that we in the academic side will get from our empirical research simply will not hold. And this is one of those examples. In the macro data that we have, scant as it is, you can literally see the new economy eating up the old economy. I'll just give you one example and one for Bob, which you may have seen or not seen. It is in the capital spending area. If you look at capital spending in the United States, by the way, in the decade of the 90s, capital spending is driven, along with consumption, our marvelous expansion. It's very unique in our business cycle history. The proportion of equipment spending to total capital spending now stands at 81%. 10 or 12 years ago, it was 60 or 65%. The proportion of equipment spending that's in information processing and software is now on the order of 53.5%, and that's up from 5 years ago, 40%. But when you look to see, if you look at consumption spending on computers and similar kinds of new economy stuff, if you look at exports, you can see tremendous growth in terms of the ratio in our economy of these new activities. And I would submit that the people who are doing the data can't keep up with it. They're not even measuring it right. It's so new.
Robert Shiller, your turn.
Well, I don't think that these data that you cite are really contradictory to what I've been saying. Yes, we are growing into a new economy, but do we want such enormous price-earnings ratios? Does it really warrant what we've seen? So I'm not convinced by Alan says that markets have a way of telling you in advance what's going to happen. And I think that may underlie a lot of people's thinking. It's partly true. Markets, especially for short run, you know, the futures market for federal funds rate, for example, predicts what the Fed is going to do. But the stock market is pricing earnings onto the indefinite future. The value that we see in the stock market today depends on earnings going out 10, 20, 30, 100 years. And it's in that arena that these numbers that you talk about from year to year have to be judged with a lot of skepticism and really ask what is new about the long run out, the really long run outlook for existing companies that suggest such high valuations.
Explain it, Alan, and cite a company or two as examples.
Well, let me first say something generally and then specifically. Let's think about the old economy for a moment, and let's take the Dow Jones, which is thought of as the old economy index. The Dow Jones, as of this morning, was down 5% for the year. The S&P 500 was up 1.7%, and the Nasdaq, which is largely the so-called new companies, is up 16%. And the P/E ratio on the Nasdaq is about 90, so that's a big number. And on the Dow Jones, it's about 20 something. Even that, by certain historical standards, is a high number. Now, these P/E ratios, what do they mean today? I would say we can't use the old standards on P/E ratios because they are biased by the 70s and 80s, which were terrible times in our history, times when we had a lot of money going for defense. We don't have a world at war anymore. And I tend to toss out a big chunk of recent history on P/E ratios and say that when we take the historical P/E ratios and use them as a standard, that's a mistake in a world that has changed so much. Now, on the Dow Jones, if we look at those 30 companies, by our count, 25 of them are old economy companies, and that includes Procter & Gamble, that includes DuPont, that includes Eastman Kodak, General Motors. A few of them are new economy companies, like Honeywell International. I would put American Express Financial Services in that category. And what's the problem for those companies? The problem, cyclically, as we go ahead, is They're facing rising costs, interest costs, energy costs, material costs, and labor costs around the world, just because of the structure of their business. Their revenue growth is very steady, very sure, but their revenue growth is fairly modest. Coca-Cola will have a steady but fairly sure revenue growth. So their potential is limited. And for an investor, when they look at that, the next 3 to 5 years, that is what they would say. And when you look at the next cyclical effects on these companies, and the rising costs and the attempts of the Federal Reserve to slow things down and what higher interest rates would do, they're impacted more. Now, when you go to the S&P 500 has about, by our count, 40% of the companies are new economy, 60% old. It's closer to 25%. Companies are... Are
25% new, 75% old.
Yes, that's right. And of course, the capitalization is very different. But then, when you look at a new, let's take a Cisco or let's take a Microsoft. Now, look at the world economy, which is now recovering and a major upswing, and what the world companies around the world buy to prepare for business and finance at this time. Yes, people buy Coca-Cola. But companies buy and individuals buy stuff that Cisco makes as part of the infrastructure of internet and computers and networking and systems. That's big stuff. And the world is buying a lot of it. Second, Cisco is a big exporter. The world looks at us and companies like that as the coiners and the winners. We had a wonderful performance in the 1990s, and they're wanting to do the same thing. And, of course, we invented all this new stuff, the internet, the technology. We made it work in applications form, and we produced an incredible record.
I'm getting more exuberant every minute you speak. What's irrational about that, Professor Schiller?
Well, if you take a long-run perspective, you can find stories like this in the past. So Cisco, what is its P.E. now? It's stratospheric, right?
Oh, it's kind of incredible. I'm not suggesting you buy Cisco stock at these levels.
But it's not just Cisco. Coca-Cola, I think, has a P.E. over 50. And this is a stock that you say has steady earnings growth. Well, it probably is steady, but it's not just new economy. People are in love with Walmart and other things that are symbolic of the successes of this country that may not be even high-tech. So I don't know. I mean, if you go back, you can see It's hard to find examples of companies in the history with PEs over 100 that ultimately did well. In fact, Jeremy Siegel in a recent Wall Street Journal article says there are none. What example? Let's go back. What had astronomical PE ratios? Well, Polaroid, around late 60s, early 70s, had a PE close to 100. That was a flamboyant, you know, Edwin Land, we all remember him. He invented a million things, exciting things that attracted consumer interest. That was the internet stock of that time. And it has consistently lost something over 10% a year since then. There just is no example of such PEs being right.
The phone's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about the exuberance of these markets. I'd just like to mention a long, interesting lead article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about the stage at which the old economy is buying into the new economy, not only, you know, General Electric or General Motors, for example, using the new technology, but going online and buying the big old companies like Eastman Kodak, buying into these companies. So they're feeding off each other. They're both making each other richer all the time. To me, Professor Shiller, that's an argument that this exuberance is here to stay for a long time.
I think that it may be here to stay for a long time, meaning a couple of years or more. You know, I may have different reasons for thinking that. I'm thinking about public perceptions. I view this as really an enormous landslide of public attention to some new technology, which is misplaced, but will probably a good chance of it continuing. I am not able to forecast in the short run.
1-800-423-8255, connection listeners. Are you in this market to stay? Do you believe the new economy is real? 1-800-423-TALK. Paul is on the line.
This is Paul.
Hello, Paul.
Hi. Welcome. I had boy, it's so interesting. Thanks for taking my call. I had an original question, and then I had one that just came up as you were saying that. So my first question was, has anybody done any serious sort of studies to analyze who exactly is driving this market? Who is buying the stocks? Who is doing the trading? Is it baby boomers with 401ks? Is it venture capitalists? Is it rich geeks who have sold their companies? Is it average people? Who is it? And the second question is, how much of this is just something that is become just way bigger than economics or anything that either of your guests can analyze and just become sort of like a cultural phenomenon?
Paul, your questions are very much the stuff of Professor Schiller's books.
Yeah.
Book, and he says it is a cultural phenomenon. It's partly driven by the way the media covers business these days. Who is buying these stocks, Professor Schiller, and why?
Well, of course, the opinions... The natural division is individual versus institutional. I think that both of these groups are similar in their behavior, but it is true that individual investors' involvement in the market has risen dramatically. It's now almost half of individuals have a stake in the stock market. I think maybe some of the attitude change has been more striking among individual investors than institutional. I've been surveying both of these groups. Individual investors seem to have a lot of confidence in the market, and that may be the bigger factor. You mentioned also the baby boom. That is another factor, that we have a lot of people who are saving for retirement age right now. And also we have the perception that there are a lot of such people, which helps boost the markets. And 401k plans are also a very important phenomenon. The government has effectively encouraged companies to set up plans for people to buy stocks. You know, that ought to boost the market. All these are factors. There's so many different things that happen to converge at this time to create this very unusual market situation.
But you make your own point that it is a cultural phenomenon. It is more fashionable and more important to be rich, to look rich, have a broker in the new century than it ever was before.
One thing that I find troublesome about the current cultural attitude is that we admire too much people who made money fast through some fast dealings, and we've lost our admiration for people who really make this economy work. The caring professions, our nurses, our teachers, the people who do essential things like the policemen and the firemen. The cultural atmosphere we're in kind of makes these people look like suckers. Like, you know, why didn't you make a lot of money? And that is a very unfortunate attitude right now.
Alan Sinai, is it as soft and fuzzy and cultural as all that?
No, I really don't think so at all. Actually, in terms of who's buying, it is across the board at this point now. And the issues that all the many buyers have, and the institutions have, and we have in the valuation work we do is what really is the right price. The phenomenon we accept as real and the wave of the future. That's fundamental. You either accept that or you don't. And the research we've done on that tells us that for the U.S. and the world, this phenomenon is quite real, and the anecdotal evidence and surveys that we do tell us that it's really quite real. Pricing is another issue. As far as the culture phenomenon, in terms of instance, yes, there's some momentum that goes on, but I think this is bottom line money. You make it or you don't make it. And what I've learned from investors, institutional and others over the years is that they're very fickle, and if they can make money, they'll make money. It is not fundamentally a culture phenomenon. It's fashionable to be in these kinds of things. I think it's the reality of the prospects and the micro evidence of people who work, do finance, produce and consume that tells a lot of investors intuitively that really this phenomenon is for real and they want to be in it. Pricing is another issue. These P/E ratios is another issue. We will eventually have corrections even in the NASDAQ for various reasons. But the phenomenon, and I want to stress this, is part of a wave that is very different from anything that's going on in history, in my opinion. It's a very, very big thing. And I've seen a lot of smart corporate executives, financial people, research analysts, and I think our work is quite solid. That in terms of the reality of the phenomenon, it is absolutely, absolutely there.
Robert Shiller, there is cultural wave here. Everybody has a friend who has a friend who has a friend who's made, you know, $200 million overnight on a .com, and we all talk about it. At the same time, the logic would be that the money creates the fashion more than the fashion creates the value, no?
Yes, well, this is something that I talk about in terms of speculative bubbles. Can I just insert something in response to Alan's recent remark about the reality of this phenomenon? Think back, if you will, to the year 1989 when it was announced with great fanfare in the newspapers that scientists Fleischmann and Pons had invented cold fusion, which would create a vast new energy source. Economical, and we wouldn't need oil anymore, or coal, or any of the gas, all of those would be possibly replaced. Now, that turned out to be wrong, but at the day that it broke, it was seriously accepted as a possibility by scientists, and it was reported in the newspapers. So if markets were reacting rationally to news about fundamental new innovations, this one sounds bigger than the Internet. This is an enormous innovation. What did the stock market do? It sagged a little bit. It did nothing in response to that. Why didn't it? Well, think about it. People don't react that much to some remote story about physics labs. It's not part of the market culture. And so it had no impact on the market. The Internet has such an impact on the market because it's entered our homes, it's captured our imaginations. We are working with it. We're talking about it all the time. That's a cultural difference, and that's why the Internet has so much bigger impact on the market than cold fusion did. It's just orders of magnitude bigger. There's no effect of cold fusion on the market.
I'm glad you agree that it's huge magnitudes bigger. The reality of use of the Internet is tremendous cost savings for the companies, the old economy companies that Chris mentioned that are buying into this. They're buying into it because it's saving them tons of money and helping their profits and helping the productivity of their companies. It's their way to compete since they can't grow revenues as fast as other companies can. And that's tangible evidence that it's something that really matters and is worth the attention that's being paid to it.
It's a caller's turn. 1-800-423-8255. John is on a car phone.
Yes. Hi, Chris.
Hello, John. Welcome.
Excellent show. And, of course, I'm of the impression, I think both are right, and panelists, and excellent comments. I may have missed a few points in the interim, but I just wanted to say that I think it's the new economy that is fueling the old economy stocks. And furthermore, it seems that the world is awash in cash, or has been for quite some time, and that the valuations that we're talking about possibly should be discounted from the sheer impact and the volume of the populations absorbing these products, including small, medium, large companies, and that the technology is so pervasive and will have such an enormous impact on corporate development in the future that we are in a temporary situation where the PE ratios are so high, and we're just trying to begin to absorb that volume. But that the type of technology that it is, the pervasiveness of the product distribution, and the fact that we are going global, and there is going to be a lot greater capacity to absorb this technology, that it's really the new technology companies are going to be fueling the growth of the old, and the greater efficiencies are going to be created as a result. That more investors are drawn into the market far more than ever existed in history of the country. And that due to all this activity combined, I feel that there's a enormous potential ahead from this, and that we are really entering a new era.
John, thank you. And let's not forget that the old companies are buying into the new at the same time. We seem to have entered a kind of hybrid moment. We're talking about the old economy and the new, rational and irrational exuberance, with Professor Robert Shiller of Yale and the forecaster Alan Sinai. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The new economy, old economy, rational or irrational exuberance economy. Robert Shiller, the Yale economist, has written a sort of a stubborn re-argument of the point Alan Greenspan made 4 or 5 years ago, that stocks were overpriced at around 6,000 on the Dow Jones. They're now approaching 11,000 again. It's still irrational exuberance, Professor Shiller says. Alan Sinai of Primark Decision Economics, a well-known forecaster in his own right, says, no, the new economy is thoroughly real, and the Dow Jones is probably wiser than the professional economists. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. We haven't mentioned these rising interest rates. Your friend Alan Greenspan is still trying to dampen this thing down, Professor Shiller, and the rising oil prices. I mean, triple what they had been. What is that doing to this economy and to this incredible turbulence in the markets?
Well, I think Alan Greenspan is concerned about the market, and he is raising interest rates, and will probably continue to do so. I think that's the right step. There's no way that he can solve the problem just through interest rates. Another step that he might take, which he doesn't show any inclination of taking, would be to raise margin requirements on stocks. And I think it might be a good step for him to push initial margin requirements up to, say, 60%. But he's not going to do that because he claims publicly he doesn't know that the market is overpriced. Although I suspect in the back of his mind that's what he thinks, but he's being very cautious in his statements. I don't think he's going to raise margin requirements.
Could I just presume to say the fundamental argument here, it seems to me, is the old caution that you never escape the business cycle. There's nothing new under the sun, and what goes up will come down. That's basically where you're coming from, Professor Shiller. And a notion that's way out there, that this electronic revolution, computers, the internet, the genome, astronomy, in every dimension of science, we know vastly more, have vastly more access to what we know, more practical uses of it than we've ever had before, that this is a revolution, not just an extension of the telegraph. It may be bigger than movable type, maybe even bigger than the wheel. Do you want to make that case, Alan Sinai, that this is a fundamental moment in the history of the of the species, maybe the universe?
Well, I'm with you on that, at least in the language you used, Chris, and I'm on record as having said that. And
Which of my wise things did you say many years ago?
No, it wasn't many years ago. It was about a year ago. It was that it was the biggest thing since, I guess, I said the printing press, and I'm kind of revising that, that was a little too pessimistic. And so, you know, the scientific side of us has to be careful about wild speculative opinions without a lot of data behind it. But let me give one example and then get back to your question about the business cycle and whether this is a different business cycle in the U.S. and I would submit worldwide than any we've had before. These days, if somebody figures out a product or a service that a market wants because of the Internet, it can be broadcast, sold, and marketed all over the world. And that creates a market availability that never existed in the history of mankind. If I should find some clever way to write a newsletter and have it translated into a whole bunch of languages, and it actually is viewed as valuable by a bunch of investors around the world, I can instantaneously sell it and market it around the world at extremely low cost. By the way, the cost of the telegraph and telephone is far greater than the cost of transmitting anything through the Internet. The cost of this is almost nothing. That creates a tremendous revenue opportunity, which I wish in my business I could figure out exactly how to do, because then we would be going IPO and collecting all that money. But part of this anecdotal story is to give you some idea of the motivation, and Bob, some idea of the motivation, what surrounds the tremendous rush of activity into this this new stuff. Now, for sure, it's overdone, it's overfunded, and we'll have some day of reckoning. Now, on the business cycle, and I've been saying this for a decade, this is a different business cycle, certainly for the U.S. We think it will be for other countries around the world. There's been none like it in the history of the American economy back to 1850. It's structurally different from anything before, and some of the big structural changes were the end of the Cold War, the different way we manage, the different way we work now, the productivity improvement, which was not measured right by the data. We also have a different kind of monetary policy. Monetary policy these days is forward-looking. It has changed the dynamics of the business cycle. The Fed takes action now to prevent a problem later. And we have a budget surplus, conscious, deliberate result in our economy and of our body politic. Tough thing to do, but we now are running a budget surplus. So is Canada. So is the U.K. Not budget deficits, and we had budget deficits for all of our professional history. The underpinning structurally, plus technology, of what is going on in business and finance today is so radically different from anything behind any of our other business cycles back to 1850 that I feel quite comfortable in having said for a decade and now pointing to the last decade, 10 years of business expansion, as having justified that view that this really is a new business cycle that we have seen.
Do you want to shoot it down before we go to callers, Professor Shiller?
Yeah, one thing that's striking to me about this discussion, it's true that we are going through a period of technological change. The funny thing that to me is that the next thing that we talk about is how great it's going to be for the stock market. But this technological change has all sorts of impacts. And I think that a much more important question is what effect will this have on the American wage earner? The Internet makes it possible for people to compete with people living in this country all over the world. There's stories recently about India and Asia taking away jobs. So that is a big issue. And why aren't we talking about that? Well, it's partly because in our culture, the stock market has an enormously exaggerated importance. Part of the reason is it's so much fun. There's a sort of gambling that we do in the market. There is no market for the labor, for wages. Forget about that. Let's play the game. And so there's this focus of attention on the stock market right now, when the real issues are not even related to that.
Alan Sinner.
Yeah, Professor Bob, he's really right. This is the issue of pricing. And what I'm talking about a lot of the time so far in the discussion is the reality of the phenomena beneath what's going on. The issue of whether the stock market for an index or overall is pricing earnings or revenue growth and prospects correctly or is overpricing is a real one. And I think there are lots of examples where we have overpricing and there will be corrections. Crashes, I would say no, but corrections, yes, and we've already seen one in the Dow Jones and S&P 500 this year. We haven't yet quite seen it in the NASDAQ, but that tends to happen as part of cyclical economics. So he's quite right when he hones in on the some of the fads, some of the game playing, some of the enrapturement, wherever we go on our vacation, people with their cell phones calling their brokers, that kind of thing. These are signs of speculative excesses, and I absolutely agree that they exist, and we will have some problems in the sense of volatility and corrections because of that.
1-800-423-8255 makes the exuberance connection. Seth is on the line. Hello, Seth.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi. What I want to know is, I'm one of the few 20-somethings who it seems isn't worth several billion on paper. And I feel like I can't afford the new economy. I feel like I'm in a position where I live in Boston, and Boston's getting to the point, San Francisco is getting to the point where you can't even afford to live not only in Boston, but even in the suburbs. You know, what happens?
Why don't you get rich, man? This is your moment.
I wish I could. But what happens to those people who is there a point at which the economy naturally clamps down and says, okay, well, a lot of people can't afford this, or does all this internet money then end up fueling it even further and leaving a lot of people behind?
There are a lot of people who have made millions and billions of dollars. I think, I don't know your educational background, your training, what you're trying to do in terms of jobs. There's very clear direction in terms of how we should be trained and equipped and the skill set that we take to the marketplace from all that's going on. Not just what the markets are saying, I wouldn't look at that, but I'd look at what's going on in business and finance. Second, there is in this country the great ability we have. Other countries don't have mobility. I love Boston. I love those areas you mentioned. They are terribly expensive, especially housing.
You could have found a good rich job or a cheap house in North Dakota someplace.
Well, unfortunately, you may find a lot of other parts of the country are really very appealing. We all pay a price to live here in Boston, those of us who live in this area. I've been living here for 30 years, and I'm still, no matter what goes on professionally, I manage to somehow stay here.
Seth,
it's expensive, too.
Okay, thanks.
Good luck. 1-800-423-TALK is the connection phone. Newcomb is on the line.
Chris, good morning. How are you?
Excellent. I'm not rich yet, but I'm feeling good.
You and me both. I just wanted to comment that I continue to be fascinated by your program and all of the guests that you share with us.
Good.
I wanted to quickly quote from a piece. I happen to work in this industry that a fellow at our firm had put out. Maybe make a quick comment and then hop off so I can listen to the answer. And the quote is, not to pick on a Yale man, but this happens to be a distinguished professor of economics, wrote, stock prices have reached a permanent and high plateau. That was a fellow called Irving Fisher in the summer of 1929. And I wonder if we've been able to drill beyond the cultural implications of all of this down to the psyche of the investor and how that psyche produces some of the valuations that we're seeing right now.
Professor Schiller.
Yeah, well, I'm a big admirer of Irving Fisher, but he wasn't right on everything. He wrote a book right before the 1929 crash, in which he said, we have to have new standards for the price-earnings ratio, that the old levels are out. I thought I heard Alan say that just a minute ago. So it's very instructive to read Irving Fisher's book, because he is so convincing about new technology and new business methods that inevitably are going to make the 30s a very prosperous time. And he was a good writer and very convincing. So what did we have? We were developing the automobile. We were surfacing the highways throughout the country. We were developing electricity. The whole country was wired now. And radio was now, and television was coming. He goes through a long list. And labor unions, he claimed, were becoming more cooperative with management. A long list of things like that. It sounded really good. You should really read that book and compare it with the kind of things that are said now.
Alan Sinai?
You know, I wouldn't say that we can't have something terrible go wrong and something that's a calamity, but the problems of the decade of depression are very well documented, and it was a very special set of very negative circumstances in institutions and monetary policy and in the banking system. We're protected against those kinds of things happening again. We're not protected against different kinds of things happening again. As to the caller's question about what I think he's referring to as the herd instinct in psychology, there definitely is that going on right now. And it is, and I'll repeat what I said before, there is enough speculative excesses going on. Remember, I'm making a distinction here between what's fundamental and real
yes.
as a wave of the future and what is in the pricing of the market, the psychology of the market. And it's overdone in a number of places, in my view, and we will have corrections. We will have comeuppances because of that in a number of ways. For example, people are flocking. The venture fund funds are flocking to anything with .com on it, whether these companies will do well or not. There's an overinvestment in that. These companies are turning money away. I hear anecdotal stories where we have all the money we need. We don't want money. Money is chasing these things. That's a very bad sign to me that the people are not doing their work and calculations of what the returns will be on that money. And a lot of our younger people are flocking there on the promise of stock options and millions of dollars and situations that will never come to fruition. So that to me is a sign of speculative excess.
1-800-423-8255. Jay is on a car phone.
Hi.
Hello, Jay.
I have a quick question that I'd like your analyst comments on. There's a gentleman who wrote a very simplistic and also very interesting sounding theory. The guy's name is Harry Dent. And Harry wrote a book that says, it's all about consumption of consumers and buying things. And if you look at the spending patterns of people over the course of their life, they reach a peak spending at around 46 years old. And then if you equate that to baby booms and then kind of time shift everything, looking at population numbers and peak earning and peak spending periods, we're in a period now where the peak birth rate of the baby boomers are reaching their peak spending years, which is what's driving all the consumption, which is in turn what's driving all the companies that are going to be able to sell things across .com or whatever. And that when we hit the peak and start the downside of the baby boom, we'll see a crash in the economy. And he cites a couple of examples. He did that mapping in Japan and showed that Japan's economy would slow down in the early 90s. He also applied it to Europe and said that they're behind us in terms of the baby boom, but that their economies are tracking relatively closely to that kind of proposition, as the U.S. is kind of prima facie evidence of what he's...
Professor Shirley, you refer to Harry Dent in your book. You want to comment?
Right. Yeah, actually, I read Harry Dent, and actually, I have these 12 precipitating factors, of which one is the baby boom. However, I don't think it's quite as important as Harry Dent says. One thing is that the rest of the world is not... The baby boom has been strongest in the United States, but the rest of the world, while there's evidence of a baby boom also, it's much weaker. And so what we're seeing is the growth of these economies, and eventually they are going to want to invest in the United States. So it's not as big a thing. What may be more important is the perception of the baby boom. Harry Dent has sold millions of these, or a large number of these books, and others have also made a lot of attention to this point. People think that the baby boom is reason why the market can't go down for a while, and that's part of the source of the strength of the market.
1-800-423-8255. Javed is on a car phone.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome.
Chris, there's the famous German folk hero, Baron Munchausen, who once was asked how he climbed down from the moon. And he said that, well, I climbed down my rope, cut it from the top, and tied it to the bottom and kept climbing down. it seems to me that is kind of what we're talking about, and it's kind of indicative of the times we're in, which is...
You're speaking as a close personal friend of Baron Munchausen.
Yes.
Okay.
It's wonderful you got that name pronounced right.
So it seems to me, personally, I'm a technology worker myself. Not a millionaire yet, but hoping to get there. Now, it seems to me that, the new economy that we're talking about is again, something that's come out of this whole rational exuberance thing. I mean, what I mean is, if we go back to, the gold rush, the people who made the money were the, people who sold the picks and shovels.
And the dungarees,
But was that something that, once again, fundamentally changed the world? Or was it just a temporary plumbing fix? So I guess that's my question. I mean, we seem to be in the middle of a spike in kind of economic time. And
well, you've heard Alan Sinai. He believes it's the biggest thing since maybe the written word, maybe even bigger than Gutenberg. And I'm beginning to think so myself, not just the Internet, but throw in.
I think it depends on what people focus on. What the caller sees is correct. There are elements of the gold rush. There's a lot of speculation out there. I see that, but I also see the fundamental difference in wave because of the efficiencies of the new technology in things like the distribution of where we consume and how we produce and where we produce and how we invest in the capital spending sense. And this is all over the world. So it's a very fundamental infrastructure kind of thing. It's just that the infrastructure today is very different from the kind that the caller is talking about. And it's something harder to get your hands around. By the way, on the Harry Dent thing, just very briefly, he has, as Bob correctly identified, picked out a part of the prosperity and very articulately presented it and sold millions of books. And he gives wonderful speeches. He's one of the highest paid speakers. I envy him on the speaker's circuit. He's very good at that. This expansion in the 1990s in the U.S. has been investment-led. It's very unique in terms of the growth propensity, very unique in our history. It's been led by the technology boom. And it's important to know that. And that technology has helped us get productivity up, and the productivity is part of the prosperity we see. I see it going on in other countries around the world now, much like it went on in the U.S. So I do think we're going to have tremendous prosperity in most of the world as we go through the next 5 years.
1-800-423-8255. Richard is on the line.
Hello there.
Hello, Richard.
I'm calling because I find myself personally in my life right now very much involved with what you're talking about. I have a dilemma that's keeping me awake at night. I have a small business. I've owned a small business, a brick-and-mortar company, for 15 years. Not brick-and-mortar per se, but as opposed to internet business. Have made a very nice living. The business is growing steadily and for the foreseeable future. And suddenly I'm being courted by an upstart B2B.com company that's, just like you mentioned earlier, having VC money thrown at them that they're actually refusing now. And this company is saying, why don't you come on with us, join us, do what you do, but do it for us, B2B. We're going to wave some serious stock options in front of your nose that are worthless today but could be worth a tremendous amount in a very short time. They're going to go public within a year. And here I'm wrestling with, do I dump what I have to join this really fast-moving train, or do I stay put and watch it go by?
Good question. How do you judge something like that, Alan Sinai or Bob Shiller?
I hope people don't lose sight of the real bricks-and-mortar business that they're doing that contributes to society. And there's a tendency right now, it's an unfortunate tendency, to think in terms of this dot-com market. And sometimes business people will do things that they don't believe themselves are good. They're just doing it for the appearances so that the market will buy that. And I hope that doesn't happen. We kind of have a moral imperative to keep our eye on the ball and not jump at dot-com opportunities when they don't make real sense.
By the way, for more information on topics like this, you ought to read what Lou Gerstner, the head of IBM, has been immensely successful, says about this new revolution, the pluses and minuses of it. Or you could tune into some of the things that Mike Milliken says, and that's very, it could be very controversial.
So what should Richard do? Should he?
But I think this particular situation is very tough. It's a nitty-gritty individual business decision, and you've got to have some advice on that in terms of looking at the nitty-gritty of the deal that they're offering you. I think over my professional and personal lifetime, I've heard more stories of people saying they wish they had bought the piece of land. They wish they had bought the house. They wish they had made this investment. Look what happened. And their intuition said, I ought to do it. And they didn't do it. And they were left holding the bag. But you've got to make sure. So I'm kind of saying, take a really good look at getting aboard this fast-moving train. But make sure with your eyes open, you've got some professional advice so you're not getting into a kind of a sucker play in terms of those stock options.
Which professionals do you believe in the end? I mean, for Richard, and how do you second guess that stock option promise?
You've just got to know what's going on in that industry. A lot of those stock options are empty promises. They're never going to be realized because they are only done if there's an IPO, if there's a buyout of the company. And people are recruiting people by telling them one of those two things will happen. And those things may not happen, and you have to realistically assess that.
Professor Shiller, we're going to remember your caution, but I think I still believe in the fundamental phenomenal change here.
Well, if I can have a parting word, I hope that many people today are putting all of their retirement savings in the stock market, and you have many young people who are taking out home equity loans or student loans to put that in the stock market. I say, please don't do that. Not now.
We are forewarned and forearmed. Robert Shiller at Yale. Thank you enormously for being with us and for the book, Exuberant, Irrational Exuberance. Alan Sinai of Primark Decision Economics, thank you for coming back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. For The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Barnes & Noble at Boston University in Kenmore Square, where Douglas Starr will discuss and sign his book, Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce, Wednesday, March 29th at 7 p.m. By the Museum of Fine Arts.